I had to stand on tiptoes. You could just about see over the crowd, and I wanted to know who was playing, and I looked and I saw this skinny black boy, and I thought, oh, that must be Arthur Ashe. I've heard about him.
I would ask him, so how are you feeling? Oh, you know, I'm okay, you know, I'm okay. And he would then turn around the conversation about you. That was an amazing thing. And I used to know him. I said, but Arthur, tell me about yourself. And he would be reluctant to talk about himself.
It was a pretty tense meeting. And then I got it about Arthur. I thought, you're more than a tennis player. You're not only a politician, you're a statesman.
Arthur probably did more as a person from the outside to help break up the apartheid system as anybody else had done.
All right, welcome everyone to the Tennis Worthy podcast presented by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I am your president, Patrick McEnroe. Very happy today to be joined by two, not just one, but two Hall of Famers, Mr. Charlie Passerell and Mr. Richard Evans. Charlie was inducted in 2013, an outstanding career both on the court and off the court as well, in starting the Indian Wells tournament out in California, amongst many other things. And Richard Evans, longtime journalist from the great country of Great Britain. So welcome to you both. We are here to discuss someone that both of you know extremely well. His statue right behind me here in the museum at the Tennis Hall of Fame, the one and only Arthur Ashe. Let me start with you, Charlie. Welcome and thank you for joining Tennis Worthy.
Thank you, Patrick. It's a pleasure for me to be here on the podcast with you and Richard. And certainly we're going to be talking about probably my favorite subject in tennis.
How about you, Richard? Give me your quick overview on the one and only Arthur Ashe before we get into the details with Charlie.
Well, I was lucky to call him a friend, one of the most remarkable people I've ever met. Did so much on and off the court for so many different people. And I love watching him play tennis, too.
Yeah, I actually have been watching quite a few of his matches in preparation for this podcast with you guys, including the match I was talking to Charlie about it before you came on, Richard, when he played with my brother at Madison Square Garden. We'll get into that as well. But I want to start, Charlie, with your first memories of Arthur Ashe. I know you guys played in the Orange Bowl when you were 12 and he was 13. Do you remember that, or was it when you both were at UCLA that you have your first real memories and you guys became obviously great friends?
No, I remember that match very well. Arthur had won the first set, and we played, I believe, in the quarterfinals, maybe semifinals of the Orange Bowl. And then I came back and beat him. But I remember him well. But even though I met him then, and, you know, one thing about that match, I was very impressed with the way he hit his backhand. I thought Arthur had one of the best backhands in the game, period. And he could do so much. So I always remembered, you know, that I said, this guy's backhand. I love to have that backhand, you know. So I remember that.
What about you, Richard? What are your first memories of when you first met Arthur?
Well, I first saw him when I was walking on that corridor that no longer exists because number one court of Wimbledon no longer exists. And he was playing on it, and I had to stand on tiptoes. You could just about see over the crowd, and I wanted to know who was playing. And I looked, and I saw this skinny black boy, and I thought, oh, that must be Arthur Ashe. I've heard about him. And so that was when I first set eyes on him. And then being on the tour, I don't know, somebody introduced me, and, you know, I was running around the circuit as a journalist, and there was no one else around. So I was mixing with the players all the time, and having dinner with Charlie and Emma and Rocket and, you know, the gang. So Arthur was part of all that setup.
Let's get into Charlie. When you got to know Arthur, I'm assuming pretty well, when you were at UCLA, you were a year behind Arthur. You were a kid from Puerto Rico, obviously coming to the West Coast, playing at the storied program of UCLA. Arthur was an African-American youngster playing in a game that didn't have that many of them. What was it like for both of you sort of being in that place at that time?
I really got to be best friends, great friends with Arthur when I went to UCLA. Interesting story about how we ended up, both of us ended up at UCLA. Arthur had pretty much decided that he was going to go to UCLA. In my situation, I still was trying to decide between going to UCLA or USC. But the tennis coach at the time, J.D. Morgan, took Arthur and I to dinner there. He was recruiting me, basically, because Arthur had already decided. And he took us out to dinner. And after we ordered our main course, J.D. put an arm in Arthur's shoulder and another arm, a hand in my shoulder. And he said, "Welcome, Bruins." I was 17 years old. I didn't know how to tell J.D. I haven't decided yet. So I ended up at UCLA. So to this day, I still look up in the sky and I said, "Thank you, J.D., for sending me to UCLA," because my time there was probably maybe the best time of my life. And that's when Arthur and I really got to become best friends.
Let's shoot ahead to this, to that Wimbledon final, because that's the focus of this particular podcast with Tennis Worthy. We know Arthur had won Richard the U.S. Open in 68. He'd won the Australian Open in 1970. He'd let one slip away against Nastasi, a big one I know that he was disappointed about, obviously, in another big final. But Wimbledon 75, you've got a young swashbuckler and Jimmy Connors, who was really dominating the tournament, didn't lose his set, I believe, coming into the final. And Arthur, meanwhile, had a pretty tough draw. He'd had a couple of really tough matches, including one against Borg that won four sets. I think it was a five-setter against Roach, Tony Roach, the great Australian, in the semifinal. So set the stage a little bit, if you could, Richard, for that championship match of Arthur going up against a young Jimmy Connors.
Well, he was extraordinary in so many different ways, not least because the two players were in litigation in each other, because Jimmy Connors' manager, Bill Reardon, was suing the ATP and Arthur Ashe personally as president of the ATP over this players' association, because Reardon thought he had one that he really didn't. His association was himself, a lawyer, and Jimmy Connors. But so that was a behind-the-scenes setup. And then you had the situation technically of Arthur's game fitting into Jimmy's so well that Jimmy always used to beat him. And as Charlie will be able to confirm, that required a little of a gathering at the Playboy Club on Park Lane the night before. I'm not sure, but I think Donald Dell, Charlie Passarell, and Arthur Ashe sat down over a dinner and said, "We're going to do something different." And boy, did Arthur do something different. He did something that anybody who's played sport at the highest level will surely agree with. To change the way you play totally, technically, on a big occasion is one of the most difficult things you can do. And Arthur, who was all swashbuckling, go slam, bam, crash, hit the ball as hard as you can, which Jimmy loved, because Jimmy was a small guy and he needed to feed off his opponent's power because he couldn't generate great power himself. Arthur and the three of them decided that the only way to do it was to take away that power. And so Arthur proceeded to softball Jimmy. Push, shove, dink, lob, and Connors fell apart. And I remember I was sitting behind Ingrid Benser, the Swedish number one, who was a close friend of Arthur's, and she turned around to me and said, "What am I seeing? What's going on?" Because Arthur was playing like we'd never seen him before. But it was exactly the right thing to do. Connors didn't know how to deal with the lack of power, and although he did get a set, which was quite an achievement, that was probably the biggest moment for Arthur. When he lost that third set, did he panic? Did he revert to what he'd done all his life? No, he was strong enough mentally to stick with the plan, because the plan had worked for two sets. He stuck to the plan, and Jimmy fell apart all over again.
Yeah, it was amazing. I want to get into the details, because I rewatched it recently. But Charlie, take us back to that night, the night before the match, when you sat down. Was it just you and Arthur, or who else was there?
No, it was Freddie McNair and Donald Dell.
Okay.
And the three of us, we loved going to the Playboy Club at that time and having dinner and gamble a little bit afterwards. And so Arthur, you know, typical Arthur, he just wanted to relax and be, you know, he didn't want to feel the pressure of the match for the next day. And so we sat down and we talked about it. And one thing, Richard, that if you remember, Arthur, in my opinion, had one of the best wide serves on the first court of anybody. And I said, Arthur, you got to put that wide serve, pull Jimmy off the court, and then just dump the ball cross court to short to Jimmy's forehand. That's the weakness. And I had seen, prior to that match, I had seen Pancho Gonzalez do that to Jimmy at the finals of the Pacific Southwest. And I said, and I remember, Terry, you know, this is what Gorgo did and beat him. You know, Gonzalez was 44 years old or something and still beat Jimmy. And I said, you got to do that. And the other thing, actually, it was Arthur talking, says, you know, we watched Raul Ramirez play, gave Jimmy all kinds of fits when they played, and he softballed him, and he lobbed him, and he just never gave anything hard for Jimmy to hit, you know, and so that's what he did. And as Richard said, he just implemented a strategy that was so foreign to Arthur's game. It's just, he never played like that before, and it was amazing.
I'd just like to end this little segment by saying it was so right that Arthur should end up as Wimbledon champion. It would have been such a shame if a player of his stature, his skill, had not won Wimbledon, because even more then than it is now, being Wimbledon champion was like being a king. It confirmed your status in the game, in world sport, and Arthur deserved that. And the fact that he did it in such difficult circumstances was such a tribute to him as a man and a player.
I watched in watching the match, as you guys are talking about, I was absolutely amazed at how many times Arthur used a lob in the first two sets. And Jimmy just kept running back like, here we go again. And it was, I mean, to beat Connor 6-1, 6-1 on grass in the Wimbledon final was just outrageous. What I want to ask you is about what Richard sort of referenced just a little bit earlier, which was, you know, that Jimmy actually did start to turn it around, or at least had a chance to, by winning that third set. And I noticed in watching the replay that he was sort of looking up at different times, Connors, almost like, I don't know who he was looking at. He looked like he was looking up at the player box. And of course, in those years, the player boxes were literally right next to each other, right, at center court at Wimbledon. And he was sort of mocking someone in the box. Were you aware of this, Richard? I mean, Jimmy was sort of like mouthing off at someone. I don't know if it was his camp or if it was someone in Arthur's camp. He was sort of mocking him. And I'm thinking to myself, this is bizarre. The guy's lost 6-1, 6-1. And he's somehow making it a match, you know, in the third set. And he's just looking up, going, you know, kind of blowing him off in the crowd. But were you aware this was happening? Because I was like amazed. I mean, I'm not amazed knowing Jimmy, but that happened in the Wimbledon final against Arthur.
Yes, I don't know who he was talking to, but there was one. I don't know if it's the same incident you're referring to, but someone in the crowd called out, do something different or something. And Jimmy retorted, I'm trying, damn it, I'm trying. And he was obviously, you know, frazzled by the whole situation because he had completely lost control of the match. He didn't know what to do. And he certainly muttered throughout the match of various people, but I don't know precisely who he was talking to.
Well, what you guys were talking about, too, and making that tactical change for Arthur, like you said, he had a great backhand. He could rip the passing shot. But he hit so many little dink balls, Charlie, when Connors did cut, because Connors came to net a lot. And repeatedly, Arthur would just sort of dip it, take the pace off it. But he'd still hit the passing shot when it was there. But it was just tactical brilliance from him throughout the match.
He was in his zone, Arthur. And if, you know, I don't know if you look at, but Arthur, when he sat down at changeovers, I mean, his face was just looking into nowhere. He just totally in his zone, in a trance.
I don't know whether you can confirm this, Charlie, but I mean, for a start, Jimmy had that weird Lacoste racket, steel racket, small head. Only he could really play with it because his eye was so good and he hit the ball in the middle of the strings all the time. But some people have told me that because of his grip and because of that racket, if you got the ball over the net at a certain level onto his forehand volley, he couldn't get the ball in court. It would either go in the net or it would go long. The geometry of that somehow forced an error, but you had to be so precise to get it right onto his forehand volley.
You're right, Richard. He had a tough time hitting short forehands with that racket and the grip. I mean, he just, you know, it was really one of his biggest problems. Yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned, by the way, Charlie, the great Mr. Gonzalez, because I know he was your hero and you played one of the epic matches ever at Wimbledon. In fact, the longest match until, well, the one we know that replaced it in the last decade or so, the Isner Hoot match, but your match with Gonzalez. You mentioned Arthur sitting down. In that when you played Pancho, there was no sitting down on the changeovers. Well, you were just, I mean, the match went over 5 hours and you guys had to stand on the changeover. What was up with that?
That's the way it was. We just did it. You know, we didn't think much of it. You know, we were in pretty good shape then.
Yeah, you sure were. So Arthur is able to win that fourth set, win the Wimbledon title, Charlie. What do you remember about the first time you spoke to him and or saw him after the match? When was that?
You know, I called him and congratulated him. And, you know, and I want to say that there were two things that I remember about Arthur's matches. One certainly was that Wimbledon final. The other one was, which I thought was an amazing, I don't know, I mean, it was meant to be sort of thing, was when Arthur won the first U.S. Open in 1968. Remember, that's the first U.S. Open. And Lieutenant Ash won the U.S. Open. And going back on what happened before that first U.S. Open is Bob Kelleher was then the president of the USLTA at the time. And he came to Arthur and I. We were the top two American players at the time, along with Clark Graebner. And he came to us and he said, what do you guys think about what we ought to do with Forest Hill? Shall we make it open? Shall we keep it as an amateur? And many people were against opening up Forest Hills, the U.S. and the U.S. Nationals did. And we said, no, you got to go the same way Wimbledon is going. You got to go. You got to open it up to the pros. We want to play against the best players. And lo and behold, Arthur wins the first U.S. Open. American player in 13 years. And so it was really, really, I don't know, maybe it was just all meant to be. Arthur to win Wimbledon, Arthur to win the U.S. Open. I think about that and I say, you know, that's amazing, you know, how things happen, you know, in life.
You guys both have mentioned briefly the ATP, right, and the start of the Association of Tennis Professionals, which is the men's running the men's tour. And you guys were both very much involved in creating the ATP in the late 60s, obviously into the early 70s. So Arthur's role in that and your guys' role in that was, you know, creating history and, you know, changing the way modern tennis is seen. And we see the results of it today with the tournament in Indian Wells, Charlie, that you started years ago, which is, you know, just so incredibly successful, these events outside the majors. What about the involvement that you had, Richard, in that, and also having someone like Arthur involved in that as well?
Obviously, we had Cliff Drysdale as the first president. Arthur became the second president. And of course, the whole boycott thing is another subject. But I always remember my personal involvement was I was European director of the ATP, running a professional tennis for Europe from Benny Berthet's cupboard in his women's dress shop off the Champs-Élysées. You pretty much had to go in sideways. There was room for myself, a secretary, and one other person, as long as he was as slim as Arthur Ashe. Arthur, as soon as he became president, took it upon himself to start writing the rules of the game for the professional game, which obviously needed tweaking for various reasons. And he at Roland Garros in particular, he spent time going around the locker room, talking to people like Freddie McNair and Sherwood Stewart and goodness knows who else, and getting their opinions. And in his meticulous way, writing it all down. And then he said, I need an office. Can I come and use your office? I said, if you can get in, you certainly can. So he sat there and he wrote up his notes. And there was a bistro on the corner of the Rue Ponthieu. It's still there, the cafe. They don't know they were the scene of history being written for the game of tennis. But I took him to lunch there a couple of times, and we continued writing the rules of the game. And that how seriously Arthur took his role as president. He was writing the future of professional tennis.
An interesting thing about that, Richard, it's that anybody that's been president of the ATP, his ranking has plummeted. Arthur's went up. He's the only guy that could do both. I mean,
how did you do that?
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the, I mean, obviously we know now looking back on Arthur's legendary career on the court, right? But off the court is obviously where he had an even bigger impact. So when you think about Charlie, that special uniqueness that he had, right? That he could be a great tennis player, but that he could realize, I guess, his destiny, right? To change where I'm looking at a telex sent to him from Jackie Robinson when he won the U.S. Open. And in it, I'm going to turn around and read it. He said, "You will also affect the decency of all Americans," you know, was his last line of the message he sent to Arthur. But I guess my question to you is, Charlie, having known him for so long, when did he realize, did Arthur Ashe realize that he, whether it was the responsibility, the desire, whatever it was, to change the world, to change the tennis world, but also to change the world? When did he realize that? And when did he say, this is something I have to do?
You know, that's a good question, because Arthur was my buddy. You know, he was my close friend. We shared an apartment together. When we were going to UCLA, it was a one-bedroom apartment. We had two single beds next to each other. And, you know, I mean, he was just a friend. And I think back now, and it was amazing, because especially Arthur, but really we were a special generation of players. I was so fortunate to be. Think about what was going on in the world at the time. We had the assassinations of both Kennedys, the assassination of Martin Luther King, civil rights movements, the war in Vietnam, all the stuff. And here we were trying to figure out how to hit a forehand, you know, what all the stuff was going around us. And open tennis, you know, it was 1968, you know, and somehow I didn't really realize what an unbelievable person Arthur would end up being, you know, to be honest. I mean, he was my buddy. He was just, you know, like, he's just another guy. And that's the way Arthur behaved around all of us. You know, he never really say, we got to do this. Or he never really imposed his will on any one of us, you know. And he was always... Actually, one of the things that annoyed me about Arthur was that it was hard to sometimes. I would ask him, Arthur, so how are you feeling? Oh, you know, I'm okay. You know, I'm okay. And he would then turn around the conversation about you, not about him, you know. And that was an amazing thing. And it used to annoy me. I said, but Arthur, tell me about yourself. And he would be reluctant to talk about himself.
Well, that was largely Dr. Johnson's teaching, wasn't it? I mean, Dr. Johnson, with whom Arthur lived in Virginia after he left home in Richmond, he went to Lynchburg. And Dr. Johnson, from what I've read, told Arthur, you're going to enter into a white world when you become a top player, and never let the white man have an excuse to criticize you. That is an order, if you like, a suggestion that many black people wouldn't have been able to handle. But Arthur's temperament allowed him to follow those orders. And I think I don't know if you heard him say this, Charlie, but he surprised me, having been around him as much as I was, not as much as you. Later in life, he said, I never left my New York apartment to walk on the streets of Manhattan without knowing I was a black man. And that tells you so much. But he kept inside himself, because I don't think either Charlie or I would have realized that to the extent that he was saying it. But he was conscious the whole time of his role in life and what he could contribute. And we'll get on to it. But, you know, Charlie was on one of them, the tours. We went to Africa and especially South Africa. And in South Africa, I got the message. I saw, which we can talk about, a couple of instances, and I thought, "Boof, you know, you're a bit special."
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. And before we do, I want to mention something that the great Jesse Jackson said, of course, a longtime activist for the Black community. And he brought Arthur into the fold at one point when Arthur was young, and he was obviously, you know, I don't know if it was after he won the Open or Wimbledon. And there's a great line from Arthur responding to Jesse, who said something to the effect of, "Hey, Arthur, the only thing you need to do is you need to, you know, get yourself out there. You need to be more vocal. You need to, you know, scream and yell. And this is how we change things." And Arthur said something to the effect of, "Well, Jesse, you do you and I'll do me." And I think that sort of sums up, Charlie, what you were talking about, that, you know, but I just wonder where that internal knowledge and character that Arthur had, where that came from, right? That he was so comfortable in who he was, and that how he handled things was the way he was going to make change for the world.
Actually, what Jesse said to Arthur is this: "Arthur, you're not arrogant enough."
I was trying to be nice. Okay.
And Arthur says, "You're right, Jesse. You know, I am not arrogant." He says, "But I don't think that my lack of arrogance is lessens my effectiveness." That's what he said.
Yeah, interesting. All right, let's talk about the South Africa trip, Richard, and what that meant for you guys, what that meant for Arthur, and just what it meant overall for tennis in the world.
Well, briefly, Donald Dell, who of course was Arthur's closest friend and his agent, his manager and his captain, had organized through the State Department for Arthur and Stan Smith to have a tour of English-speaking African nations, to sell the game, to find players, and that was successful. That was in 71. In 72, he organized a tour of the French-speaking nations, which happened to be someone's honeymoon. If Charlie invited his bride along. That was nice of him. And it was Charlie and Tom Ocker and Marty Reeson and Arthur Ashe and Bud Collins and Frank DeFord and myself. And we went on this amazing tour of French Africa, and we found Yannick Noah, which is another story. But to get to South Africa, that was the big one. Owen Williams played a huge part in that. The story was that Arthur had his visa refused several times. He made this very un-Arthur-like comment through sheer exasperation of having been asked about the subject so often. He said, "Oh, they should just drop a bomb on Johannesburg." Oh, dear. That didn't go over terribly well. But he said it in a press conference in Paris. Anyway, Gladys Hellman came into the story because she got hold of Owen, who'd been tournament director at the U.S. Open, and they were friends. And Gladys said, "You've got to go to the president if you have to. You've got to get Arthur into South Africa. This is ridiculous." And so Owen said, "Oh, all right." And he went to the president, I think it was Botha, I'm not sure, and said, "You know, don't be afraid of Arthur Ashe. He's probably more afraid of you. But it will be so good for South Africa if you let this great black champion into the country." And lo and behold, they gave him a visa. So off we set to South Africa. I'd never been, and only when you got there did you realize the complications of the racial situation. It's not just black and white. It's black and Indian and black and colored and white. Oh, you know, it's very strange place, as Alan Paton said to us, the great author. But there were two instances. The great poet Don Matera, who wrote the most amazing poem about Arthur, which got him exactly. And Don hardly knew him, but if you ever get a chance to read the poem, it's in all the books about Arthur. And he'd arranged a meeting between Arthur and black journalists in a stuffy, unair-conditioned hall in Johannesburg. But there was a system called being banned if you did something the government didn't like. And hilariously, because they were trying to present the best face of South Africa to Arthur Ashe and to the world because of the publicity, and the banning order on Don Matera came through right in the middle of Arthur's visit, which was the last thing that the government really wanted, but the bureaucratic machinery spat it out right at that moment. So when we arrived at the hall, Don Matera was standing on the pavement and he walked towards Arthur, because the rule is, if you're banned, you can only meet with one person in public. And so that precluded him from going into the meeting. And Dom said, "Arthur, I'm so sorry, you know, I can't come in," which told you all you wanted to know about apartheid in South Africa. It was hilarious in its sad way. So Arthur goes into the meeting. It was packed with at least 100 black journalists. And the reception was not good. Somebody, as I walked past them, muttered, "Uncle Tom." Several of them got up and said, "Why are you here, Arthur? You're just doing what the government wants you to do. Show a good face of South Africa. It's not like here. You've got to realize what we go through." And they gave him a really rough time. And I was just so impressed with the way Arthur handled it. Again, never losing his cool, stating his case, trying to make them understand that he felt he was opening up doors that, you know, wouldn't be opened otherwise. But it was a pretty tense meeting. And then I got it about Arthur. I thought, you're more than a tennis player. You're not only a politician, you're a statesman. And then we went to a meeting at Stellenbosch University with a Afrikaner professor who was there with a couple of his young kids, and sat around and had a very interesting discussion. We had with us the president of the Coloured Tennis Association. That meant Indian, not white anyway, and not black. And he was a very smart-looking gentleman, I remember, in a green blazer and white pants. And we got quite heated, and I with a different temperament to Arthur, I started to get annoyed, and I got the Arthur Ashe shut up look. You know, I knew it. Calm down, Richard. Don't get annoyed. So I shut up. And the professor's young men were always trying to interject and justify apartheid. And so Arthur, towards the end, said, "Professor," he said, "well, you know, it's been very interesting, but just please explain to me something. We have the president of the Coloured Association here with us, and why is it that you can vote, but he can't?" And there was a deathly silence, and the professor said, "Mr. Ashe, I have no answer for you."
Yeah, you know, a couple of things that Richard, first of all, he was not only criticized by blacks in South Africa for going to South Africa, you know, like Richard said, they called him an Uncle Tom, but also by blacks in the United States. You know, he would, you know, because as you might remember, Richard, there was a boycott for any athlete to go and participate in events or performers, you know, singers, dancers, so forth, to perform in South Africa, because it was, you know, there was this boycott, and so he was criticized. And the other thing was that through the poet Butera, Arthur was actually secretly, which we found out much later, was secretly communicating with Mandela, who was in prison. And I don't know how they did it, but they were communicating with each other. And many years thereafter, when Mandela finally gets released from prison, becomes president of South Africa, makes his first trip to the United States, never been to the United States before. One of the first persons, Mandela, and he insisted on this, was to visit, when he arrived in New York, one of the first persons he needed to see was Arthur. And he had a private meeting with Arthur with no security, nothing. He just said, you know, "I want to go see a friend who was my friend when I needed a friend, and he needs a friend now." Arthur had already announced that he was suffering from AIDS at that time. Right, Richard?
Amazing.
What was your reaction, guys, when Arthur came back from that trip? You mentioned, Charlie, some of the criticism from African Americans in the U.S. What was the reaction once he returned?
you know, in hindsight, I mean, everybody was said, you know, he was right. You know, he because the thing was that, you know, and I think Mark Motobani expressed it very well in his book, you know, and he said, I all of a sudden I saw truly the first truly black man I have ever seen in my life. He was a young boy there. Must have been what, Richard, 10, 11 years old at the time. And he said, this is the, and he's a tennis player. So tennis is the key. I have to become a tennis player so I can be completely free. And as you know, Mark Motobani now is a prolific writer, award-winning writer. And that's really what he, you know, what Arthur said. And Mandela recognized that. You know, he's basically, he wanted to tell Arthur, and I think he did. We don't know what went on in that meeting, that private meeting, but that Arthur probably did more as a person from the outside to help break up the apartheid system as anybody else had done. And I think a lot of people will agree with that.
Yeah, Richard, with your knowledge of history of the world and tennis specifically, what is it about tennis players? You know, is Althea Gibson, obviously the first African-American woman to win a major before Arthur won as the first American man. And of course, the great Billie Jean King and others. Why tennis? I mean, I'm here in the museum at the Tennis Hall of Fame and I see the history of the sport and all the great players and so on, but all the great stories about changing the world. Why tennis?
I don't know what it is about tennis, something about it being an individual sport, glamorous. Ted Tinling always used to tell me, the great couturier who knew everybody, saying about the Pacific Southwest at the Los Angeles Tennis Club. It obviously in Hollywood they were there, but it always attracted the stars. The tournament always had Gary Cooper and Charlie Chaplin and Marlene Dietrich and all the stars courtside. And it is true all over the world. Jean-Paul Belmondo was always at Roland Garros. It attracts other famous people. But I don't know what it is. It's a chemistry. Tennis is a sport that is followed by the famous, if you like. And therefore, with it comes influence. And you somehow, tennis stars are more prominent than, apart from Tiger Woods, than any golfer. Most of the other big sports are team sports. Obviously, some stand out as individuals. But tennis is out there, and in the center court Wimbledon, it's a cathedral of sport. And anybody who plays on it gains a certain special fame. And if you're intelligent enough and willing enough and knowledgeable enough, like Arthur, to use that fame, you can do great things. And some tennis players have.
With Arthur, a prime example.
How do you feel, Charlie, being so close to Arthur for so long? And obviously he left us, you know, far too young, but in the years after he was done playing, and he was Arthur Ashe, you know, this figure. He was done playing tennis. He was sick. He had the heart attacks. He got HIV. What were his final years like as a person, and did his impact that he knew he had had on the world? How do you think he felt about that in his last 10 years of his life?
Probably those were the years that he made the greatest contributions, I think. You know, you think about all the books he wrote, and this is if you look at this Arthur statue at I know you guys have seen it at Monument Boulevard in Richmond. You know, Arthur's huge statue there, and he on the right hand side he's got a racket, on the left hand side with it's way up in the air like that, he's holding some books, and that was really important because it showed that Arthur, you know, education was probably the most more important, you know, and he used his popularity in tennis to really promote education. And that's what he did later on in his life. He talked about educating people. And, that you know, going back to something that was discussed before, I forget who the writer was, but asked Arthur one time, you know, when Arthur had AIDS and he had the heart attacks, and he said, you know, Arthur, you know, you're dealing with all these terrible things. Now, is AIDS the most difficult thing that you've had to deal with in your life? And Arthur, I think's response was something, no, I think the most difficult thing I've had to deal with me in my life is walking on the street and showing people that I'm as good as anybody else. I'm as deserving and as, you know, productive as anybody else. That's the most thing. I had to prove myself all the time. And he certainly did in spades. And, you know, I can remember now the words that Mayor Dinkins said at Arthur's funeral. But he said something, you know, Arthur was a credit to his race, the human race, you know. And that is so true. I never will forget that. And he basically said, you know, Arthur, let's face it, Arthur was better than most of us, you know, and he was.
You know, Charlie and I were speaking a little bit before you came on, Richard, just off the air. And I was mentioning him that I'd watched some of Arthur's matches, including the one he played with my brother against my brother at Madison Square Garden, you remember, in the Masters. But that led Charlie to say, what a special relationship. Yeah, I'm going to talk a little bit about my brother. I know this is about Arthur, but I think because of what it says about Arthur, and you know, John, my brother, as well as anyone, having written a very successful book on him. But that relationship between John and Arthur, how did that happen? And how did you view that of two, you know, such different personalities that sort of got each other?
Well, you know, there were the total opposites, you know, completely opposite of the spectrum. But they, you know, they somehow they develop a bond with each other that, you know, it was amazing, you know. And I have to give most of the credit to Arthur, because he really got to John, and he brought the best out of John. Let me put it to you that way. I mean, and they developed a great bond. I don't know how Richard feels about it, but
well, they wouldn't have gone out to dinner together until they were thrown together on the Davis Cup team, and then Arthur found himself in this difficult situation of having to deal with a superstar who was as different from him as you could possibly imagine, as Charlie says. I mean, two opposites. But they were both intelligent men, and they recognized the worth of each other. And very soon, despite the rows and Arthur holding his head in his hands, thinking, am I going to control this guy? A bond was formed quicker than one might have imagined. And respect. They both respected each other. And it didn't matter, you know, in the tennis concept. I remember your brother Patrick saying later on, if Arthur wants me, I'm there. Just very simple. And huge respect between the two totally different men. And what an example to humanity, to talking about humans, that two completely different people could form such a bond and respect each other. It's a lesson for everybody that should be spoken about now. Don't harp on your differences. Find out what your similarities are and how you can work together. I think Arthur benefited enormously towards, through his life, but especially at the end, having a wife like Jeannie. She was a help and an inspiration and a driving force, I think, in his whole intellectual development through the years of his life. And he wasn't a lucky person in that respect, but he was a lucky person to have found Jeannie.
Well, I'm a lucky person to have been able to spend this time with you guys reminiscing about all that you did. I want to thank both of you for all you did for professional tennis, for the ATP, for the New York Junior Tennis League, which Charlie, you and Arthur started years ago and is now all over the country. So what a pleasure and a privilege for me to speak to you guys about the great Arthur Ashe, his beautiful statue here. I'm going to read up a little more on Arthur, and I appreciate you guys joining me here on Tennis Worthy, the great Richard Evans and Charlie Passerell, both in the International Tennis Hall of Fame. Thank you both for joining me on Tennis Worthy.
Pleasure.
Thanks, Patrick.